All right, welcome to the checkout. Alan Lewis, industry legend, thank you so much for making the time to talk with us today. You know, one thing I notice about you, Alan, is you spend an inordinate amount of time, seemingly every minute of every day, combing the internet to poke holes in the intentions and worldview of this group of synthetic biology GMO propagandists. And I'd like to hear a bit more about your motivations and, you know, where you're coming from.
Well, thanks for the intro, by the way. I'm not quite sure I'm a legend. However, it's not that the symbio propaganda has to be searched out with a fine-tooth comb. It's being promoted and pushed in our faces, in my face, every time I'm online. So as a practice a few years ago, I said, every time I see something that's purely wrong and just propaganda and self-serving and misleading, I'm going to type something back. If I'm busy, you'll see me write, this is a lie. And if I'm not so busy, I'll write an 800-word essay about how this propaganda is playing out, what its roots in history are, the practical problems and dangers and unknown consequences of the technology, and then push that back against the young men and women who are in charge of the symbio propaganda. But the interesting thing, Errol, is they don't have a response. They don't have a response often because they have no idea what I'm talking about. Seriously. Or the good ones know I'm right. And the number one rule if you're in the propaganda business is never respond to the truth and never give it a platform. So let me give you an example. I'm one of those guys that really enjoys remote conferences. And I signed up for the Symbio Beta Food Conference, which brought together 150 speakers from hundreds of these little gene editing, symbio fermentation, cell culture companies to celebrate their world, to celebrate their technology, their success, their status, their funding rounds. Their
a little Symbio circle jerk, huh?
Yeah. Thank you. I wasn't going to put it that way. But it was exactly that. And it was almost impossible to raise any questions because what's a propaganda event do, right? It circumscribes everything. So you have to look through their framework and only address things through the point of view that they have. But the famous Zoom breakout session. So I ended up in a breakout session, accidentally or not, with some of the leaders of the conference. And we're talking about technology and the great, and they're going to solve this and solve that and the breakthrough. And boy, that guy from Just Foods, Tetrick, he just got an approval in Singapore, which is going to open the floodgates to a level playing field of regulation across the globe. You know, it's breathlessly ill-informed, first of all. But I asked them this question. So where does your symbio product come from? Oh, it's an all-natural ferment. Well, what's a ferment? Well, we just put microbes in with some sugars and carbohydrates and let it sit there for a while, and the microbes spit out the stuff that we want. So when it spits it out, spit out anything else you don't want? Oh, absolutely. That's a biohazard. Anything that's left over has to be incinerated. Well, what about the stuff that you separate out, but it's got all of the other stuff with it? Oh, well, it's de minimis. That's not regulated. It's not a problem. You're worrying too much. You're just afraid of the science. So what's in the ferment, Errol? Well, it's sugars. Well, where's the sugar come from? Well, I'm answering the questions at the point. The sugars come from GMO corn. GMO corn is not even food. You and I cannot eat without severe gastrointestinal distress and get no nutrition from it. It's converted to sugars. It's thrown into the fermenter. The microbes do their deal. Well, where does the corn from? It's corn. It shows up on the dock as sugar. No. That's GMO monoculture. That's 100 million acres of corn is being grown and damaging our topsoil. It's using synthetic toxic pesticides and fertilizers. Oh, well, we should fix that. Maybe we can use our technology to fix that, get some crops that don't need that. So where do you think the fertilizers and pesticides come from? Well, we're just fermenting. Well, no, you're not. Those come from fossil fuels. Mm-hmm. That's natural gas that's combined first to make ammonia or to make ammonia and then converted into urea nitrogen and then injected into the fields, completely disrupts the soil health, eliminates carbon. You end up with sterile soil, and then you spray it six times with glyphosate, the arsenic and Roundup, 2,4-D and Dyquat, et cetera, et cetera. Well, we're going to make crops that don't need pesticides.
You mean organic?
And can I ask you, where does that natural gas come from?
Right.
Oh, it's a clean energy. Really? Okay. Well, it comes from drilling deep through our topsoil, the outer plate of the earth, through all of our aquifers, and injecting the most nasty leftover caustic substances known to man into those rock substrates to melt that oil and release the gas from the sand deposits so that you can suck it up. Then you burn off the methane, mm-hmm. and you take those raw materials to make the pesticides, to fertilize, to kill the soil, to grow the damn corn. And my point is, the people doing this science have no clue. Mm-hmm. They have a title, they have a paycheck, they have stock options, and they have someone breathing down their neck to make a discovery that they can either get their next round of funding or get their exit.
Right.
Well, I just talked to you about what happens up to the dock door, right? Even if you ask them about the technology, about gene editing, about CRISPR, about TALEN, about all these other methods, the people that are evangelizing this really have no idea. And so you ask me why I'm, well, frankly, obsessed with this whole campaign. But every day, and I'm not exaggerating as I normally do, but I'm not exaggerating, every day, the Symbio Beta people and the Symbio community says, oh my God, and a groundbreaking discovery about how genes actually work. Did you know that they interact? Did you know that they're folded and that they're spongy and that they recombine physically in order to recombine chemically? Every day they admit they don't know how their technology works. Mm-hmm. They don't know the consequences of their technology, good, bad, or indifferent. All they know is that somebody's funding the research. I mean, this is really a frightening state of affairs. And you use a particular term that I'm not going to use, but it's exactly that. They're not letting anyone in who will challenge the science.
Mm-hmm. Challenge the narrative. So yeah. Let's define this now that we've sort of given like the first shots across the bow. How do they, and then how do you define these families of technologies that are called synthetic biology, that folks like us just call GMOs or GMO 2.0? Let's get sort of a technical definition. And then after that, give us a bit more color on what you mentioned, gene editing, TALEN, CRISPR, because we're both folks that have science backgrounds. I'm a biologist. Your quality
scientist, Daryl.
There you go. Well, you read a lot more about that stuff than I do now. So gene editing, TALEN, CRISPR. Let's talk about the overview. Synthetic biology.
I've been struggling with that definition for 20 years, and I have a negative definition, which is if an organism reproduces in a natural form by recombining with two different sexes, by self-replicating, by dividing, when it does that, it automatically or as part of its nature introduces additional changes or mutation. That's the essence of evolution. Mm-hmm. When those mutations make an organism more viable, then that mutation tends to stay in the genes and continue on to successive generations. So my negative generation is anytime you're stepping outside of that, then you are practicing synthetic biology. If you're breeding plants, animals, microbes in their natural way of recombining and reproducing, there's a lot of really cool technologies to manage that, to look at it, to measure the results, which are far more powerful than gene editing. And we'll get into that in a second. The problem is they're not able to be captured and capitalized and monetized, right? When you're doing breeding, you might get a ownership of a hybrid, but mostly you're getting an improved stock that is public domain that everybody can use. So you're crossing cattle, you're crossing chickens, you're crossing microbes in some way, and finding what the result is and then choosing the result that you want. Now, the important caveat is there, when you do that, the entire genome is behaving the way it is evolved to behave. When you step out of that into synthetic biology, now you're doing things that would never happen in a whole genome reproductive scenario. You're taking genes from one species that's not a fish, you're putting it in a salmon, you're using technologies to theoretically take one gene out, replace it with another, move that one over here, and then you hope for the results. And so where you end up on synthetic biology or synthetic reproduction, which is, I think, is a much easier way for people to grasp the technology. When you end up with synthetic production, what's really happening is you're making grave and significant permanent changes to a living genome. But these experiments encompass tens of thousands of attempts, to get corn to mature 3 days earlier. And in those tens of thousands of attempts, you're very carefully deciding which trait that you've magically created is one that you want to continue. But in those 10,000 attempts, you're also seeing gene damage, failure to thrive, stunting, off-target traits, all of these other things that in nature would be curtailed immediately because it's non-viable. But in synthetic biology, you're bringing forward one trait that's profitable along with all of the hidden traits that you have no idea whether there's permanent consequences for microbes, the environment, animals, the planet, public health. This is the great conceit. They're only cherry picking their successes, and they're not embracing, they're not using their own science to look at the consequences for the rest of us. Good definition?
Yeah, that's great. Now let's go into some of the particular techniques that have attracted so much attention. You know, gene editing, TALEN, CRISPR, and maybe explain the difference between these techniques and some of the transgenic techniques that have been popularized by the 300 plus million acres of GMO soy, corn, canola that's grown in this country.
I think the simple place to start is to remind people that that viruses move really easily through cell walls, as we've discovered with COVID. They're constantly moving in to organisms, including the cells in our body, and then taking up residence, sometimes forever. A lot of the deep genetic science is showing us that a good part of who we are as human beings are the old viruses that we coalesced with over millions of years. So originally they were using viruses as vectors, and they'd take a gene segment that they liked from one plant or one species, use a bacteria or a virus and infect the other plant cell, the other organism cell, knowing that over those 10,000 attempts, it would pick up that gene that you wanted through the bacteria or the viral infection. So that worked for a long time, but again, thousands and thousands of attempts. The new idea with the gene editing, which remember is purely a metaphor. There's no book, there's no pencil, there's no redlining, there's no grade on this paper. It's just a metaphor. They're sending in, I'm gonna have to make this relatively simple because it's not gene editing. They're sending in a chemical that's looking for a particular gene segment and cutting it out. Mm-hmm. So it is set free inside the cell, inside the DNA. It's suddenly set free and it's replaced by another one. So it's trying to match. There's this thing going through here and it's matching with the gene. It's saying, okay, that's the one we want to take out. And then this is the one that we want to put in that place. The couple of obvious problems with that is genes don't act in isolation. There's no trait ever discovered that was triggered by a single gene. Every gene interacts with all other genes. So between CRISPR and TALEN and all these other methods, when you're moving genes around, they are not paying any attention. In fact, they're quashing any talk about what happens to the gene snippets that are cut accidentally, that are cut loose and are floating around and recombining. What signals are being sent within the whole genome of that cell for it to adapt to this sudden and unnatural change? Because the whole genome isn't coming together with another and then dividing and assessing its natural mutations. It's having those mutations very forcefully plugged in. And so we get the trait. Over certain thousand attempts, you're going to get the trait that you wanted. You're going to get that microbe to spit out insulin, for instance, which is great. But when you do that in a living modified organism, especially one that's in the environment, you're also creating all sorts of consequential, unknown, and epigenetic changes that we are completely unable to account for. So far, so good.
What is an epigenetic change?
So so we're getting COVID right now, right? So the people that are getting COVID right now, in their DNA, they're in their immune system, it has recognized this particular threat, this kind of SARS virus. We're creating antibodies, and as an organism within our species, we now own part of that immunity. And when we reproduce, our offspring will inherit some of that ability to recognize the COVID virus or any virus and respond to it more effectively. The problem with novel viruses is that the species doesn't have good ability to react to them. The typical flu we do, we are exposed to it year after year. And even when our kids are born, they're already able to respond to it. May be unpleasant, but they're not going to die, right? That's the epigenetic effect. So when you have a bacterium or an animal or a plant, and you're changing its systemic DNA through whatever method, you're swapping out this gene, and let's say by magic, you only swapped out that gene and no other consequences happened. Well, that effect will live on in constantly remutating forms till the end of time. This is the great unknown that no one wants to talk about. Mm-hmm. And remember, genes transfer. So I'm talking about a representative of a species here that's going to transfer something epigenetically. But within my gut, all of these genes are constantly recombining. Mm-hmm. Antibiotic resistance swaps in the gut. It takes up residence in certain microbial communities, and then that passes out of your body and starts replicating in the environment. It's a massive complexity, and because we're talking about living modified organisms, the idea of it being controllable and the idea of the outcome being known is a pure and dangerous fiction.
So let's talk a bit about some of these more specific techniques. You've mentioned CRISPR and TALEN. What do those mean? What do those stand for?
I mean, I'd have to look it up. CRASPR. I'd literally have to look it up, Errol, because everyone.
don't worry about it. Don't worry about it.
But that's also, I'm going to point out that that's a problem. People who are who are enamored by these new technologies and throw out the term gene editing or CRISPR or TALEN or the 10 or 50 new ones since that old technology was created, tend to lump it into a thing that is good, okay, scientific, controllable, all for our benefit. And they kind of turn off that critical thought of, okay, technological innovation is always here. And these days it's always driven by a hyper greedy kind of profit motive. So we need to look at every one of those technologies with fresh eyes and evaluate it based on human values, based on what we want to happen. So I'm not able to answer your question about what CRISPR stands for, but I can tell you that as a group of technologies, they stand for people who are externalizing risk to the entire planet permanently in exchange for a paycheck and a payout. And that's a very bad combination. It's a very bad worldview or methodology for our scientists to be using. Mm-hmm.
Do you mind then giving us a bit more detail of how these technologies work? Like what's the method of action and the differences? Just so folks who are maybe not as scientifically literate have a better sense when they see these mentioned, especially in the context of food.
So let's not do salmon because it's just too bizarre, but let's look at the idea of creating drought tolerant crops to somehow address climate change. So what they will do is they'll look across the entire population of genetic libraries, looking for gene traits that are associated with plants that can survive on minimal water, let's say 6 to 8 inches of rain, which is pretty dry desert. And they'll delve into that plant, they'll look for the genes, they'll do a bunch of tests, they'll do a bunch of growing, this, that, or the other, and they'll use a set of really cool technologies to figure out what the likely gene or gene combinations are that allow that plant to thrive and still grow without water. So they're going to go in and they're going to extract that gene with this minute nanotechnology. And they're going to try to extract only that gene, not the nucleotides next to that, not the other proteins that are around it. They're just trying to get that little gene, nearly impossible. But let's say that they do. They're going to transfer that to a different crop. And let's say it's corn or maize for the drier northern parts of Africa. So they're going to go in and they're going to find the set of genes in the corn that they want to replicate, find the genes that they think regulate the water uptake and drought tolerance, which is this nebulous idea, and then place that gene into that spot or those set of genes into that spot. What is really impossible for them to do though is to figure out that if you're drought tolerant, how is it changing your nutrient uptake? How is it changing the color of your plant, its reaction to sun, its transpiration, how much CO2 it needs and how much oxygen it emits? All of these things are part of the whole genomic code in that plant. And they're taking one bit out and putting a new bit in, hoping for the outcome of a viable crop with all of the other traits intact that will grow a little bit better with a little less water. So, you know, okay, what else are you doing, right? So the mosquitoes are another good example. Let's change the trait that creates a male mosquito. So now all mosquitoes are going to be female in a population where they release mosquitoes that don't reproduce males. Okay. Did you ask the residents of West Africa whether they wanted that?
Mm-hmm.
What's going to happen to the other insect, bird, and aquatic populations that feed on those mosquitoes?
Right.
Those mosquitoes continue to evolve, whether they make males or females or not, because it's never 100%. They will continue to evolve and reproduce with that gene in them. Does that gene transfer? Do we eliminate mosquitoes? Well, in tests, they think not, but a test has a million mosquitoes inside of a net. And why are they doing this? Well, they're doing this because somebody's dangling $100 million over their head and saying,
right,
you want to stay in business, you better keep developing this. And I've talked to these people face to face, and their unwillingness to discuss unintended consequences and risk is just breathtaking. It's as if I am afraid of falling off of the edge of a flat earth when I ask them about living modified organisms.
So let's talk about who's funding us. You keep talking about these big dollars. Who is bankrolling this kind of research? And what do you surmise their motivations may be?
Well, history tells us a lot. We look at the agrochemical industry with seeds and fertilizers and pesticides. That's all rolled up into five, maybe four now after Monsanto was acquired by Bayer, but only four global conglomerates, the agrochemical trust, mm-hmm, right? The agrochemical complex. And it's instructive because talking with the people at SymbioBeta, they don't understand what's happening to them now. They don't understand that the 10,000 companies that are trying to get noticed and get funding and fix the world and give them stature and be memorialized in an award or the history books, they don't realize that they are already written out of history, that the agrochemical complex is creating these technologies and bolstering them because they're doing the fracking. They're making the fertilizers. They're managing the 200 million acres of GMO land, of cropland in the United States. They're managing the pesticides. They're managing the whole outcome. So they are thrilled to have all of this money coming in and supporting this research. There's a whole nother sideline, which is a tremendous amount of tech money coming out of the tech industry, where billions of dollars of fortunes were made. And they're bringing a really dangerous point of view because they're binary people in a lot of sense. They built software programs, they've identified problems, they've solved problems, they sold their software, they've created Symbio communities like Facebook and Twitter and LinkedIn and Parler that have a similar set of unintended consequences. Mm-hmm. So they're coming into the food industry feeling like they are captains of the world. Like they do nothing wrong.
They're going to save us, right? They got all the answers.
Everything they touch is gold.
Savages will need to be civilized by their Symbio genius.
They also now have to get in and get out and make a big profit, whether the product and the company survives or is successful or not. So there's this really, I'm going to call it an ugly dynamic, where all of the talk is about cures and fixes and the benefits of technology. The true motivation is financial.
Of course.
I'm going to get in, I'm going to pull this money in, I'm going to take my salary, take my exit, because they know it all rose up to a very small number of actors in the globe, right? Mm-hmm. The third leg of the financing is pharmaceuticals. And pharmaceuticals has an interesting role because the current big propaganda play is literally saying, hey, you just got a vaccine that was from a genetically manipulated virus. Therefore, you are acquiescing to all forms of synthetic biology and gene editing in synthetic manipulation of genomes.
Acquiescing? Where does acquiescing come in terms of food choices? Like how, I guess, what kind of sick individual actually draws that comparison between an emergency vaccine to stop a global catastrophic pandemic and whether or not you want your French fries to have some weird genetic tweaks that make them not turn brown?
Carol, you're giving these people too much credit for being honest, right?
Acquiescing. I mean, honestly, it feels like the word of a rapist.
Yeah. Oh, I think in your blunt way, that's exactly right. You ask for it by being subject to a novel new virus and having to take this vaccine to stay safe. Therefore, you acknowledge that the last 40 years of gene editing and the pesticides, the concentration of wealth and control of vertical integration, the removal of all other alternative healthy traditional food systems, you would just agree to that by taking that shot. But pharma,
I don't remember signing that that form in the pharmacist.
This is why I get a little obsessed with what's being posted, because right. The answer to that is bullshit with an exclamation point in place of the I, so I don't get reported for bad language.
Yeah.
But that's, you know, and I'd encourage everyone who hears this to do the same thing that I do and be unabashed about it. When you see these bullshit lies, call them out.
Yeah.
Even if it's with that one word, let the people who see it and are reading the comments or reading your repost or retweet know it's your own personal flag of truth, right? Don't wait for Jack at Twitter to do anything. He ain't going to do anything on this.
No.
Call for it. But the pharma thing's interesting because pharma's role in this is to cure diseases at the most profitable way possible. So rather than using all of this technology to prevent disease through better nutrition, through fair land access, God forbid we talk about humans and synthetic biology in the same, but access to ladder, to water, land, credit, and markets, and nutrition and open pollinated crops and reseeding and livestock and all of this that continues to drive human communities to thrive across the world, poor, rich, or otherwise. Instead of supporting that underlying fundamental requirements for human health, the pharmaceutical industry loves the fact that everybody now in the generation under 30 seems to have a complex chronic disease related to inflammation and typically through the gut microbiome and in some kind of gut distress. And that inflammation morphs into cancers and complicated things like lupus and MS and then it ends up being Alzheimer's and Parkinson's. All of these things are real known pathways, metabolic pathways, causes and consequences of these diseases. So they don't want to cure any of that. They don't invest in any of that except very minor contributions to one foundation or another, which get 10 times as much PR publicity than the donation cost. So pharma is currently using let me put it the other way. The whole Symbio community is using pharma as its cover. They're talking about how great Symbio is because it created these vaccines and because it will cure all these diseases. And by extension, it will cure all of our food, social, political, and economic problems on the planet. I mean, it's breathtaking what they believe. So there's where the money is coming in. It's all about profit. It's not about prevention. It's not about justice or fairness or equity, things that you occasionally think about, I know. And that's why this technology is being so badly misused. I'm a complete and total Luddite here, because when the Luddites saw those mills come in, and destroy their families, destroy their communities, pollute the rivers, the sky, and close the land and leave everybody impoverished. So when you did work, they taxed you to pay for when you couldn't work for pennies on the pound. I think that technology was misused because it concentrated wealth, it accumulated power, and it completely disenfranchised and damaged whole countries. And this is what we're seeing now. Even though we're kind of in love with late, you know, hyper-capitalism, those consequences of this technology are so apparent. If you just look at how this plays out yet again, 300 years after the Luddites went around smashing mills.
Yeah, and I think folks, you know, we usually use Luddites as like a disparaging term, but I would invite folks to read some more of the history of the Luddites, as that it was essentially the first modern industrial revolt by working people against the radical changes that new technologies brought to their livelihoods, not too different than what we're seeing now with AI and, you know, automation, or you know, these digital app, you know, these apps, these platforms. And so, you know, drawing out this you know, metaphor a little more broadly, let's talk then about enclosure and the concept of the commons. Let's talk about how on the micro level, you know, gene editing continues this, you know, decades long enclosure of the genetic commons and patenting of, you know, our shared genetic heritage, but also how it ties into a land grab, particularly in the global South, being headed up by, you know, obviously you've got the Bill Gates Green Revolution type boosters, but big agrochemical companies, as well as, you know, investment funds that are, you know, buying up land, and also tying that into, you know, carbon sequestration offsetting and, you know, buying these offsets. So I just want to tie this in a bit further, and this is a lot to swallow, but I, you know, using this sort of synthetic biology as sort of a starting point. I know we've talked about this, so I'm curious how you can help us think about it here.
You're exactly right. So the idea of the enclosures is that there should be and are and have been widely available open public spaces that, when managed by people or a public agreement or consensus, they can be used for hunting, for gathering, for planting, for congregating, and they're not depleted over time. They can actually be improved over time.
Right. Let me just real quick interrupt you. Eleanor Ostrom, 2009 Nobel Prize winner, spent her career documenting the existence of common pool resources, aka the commons around the world, disproving Garrett Hardin's white supremacist thought experiment of the quote tragedy of the commons, which is really just bullshit. So just so folks understand, there's literally a 2009 Nobel Prize winner who's documented hundreds of such of these examples. Go ahead, Alan, back to you.
So I want to point out, you mentioned overseas, but sometimes it's really fun to look right here in the heartland. There are 100 families that control 40 million acres of GMO cropland. Oh, great. That's efficient. Cheap food, feed the world, efficient, lower energy cost, blah, blah, blah. But the commons that's represented by that 40 million acres includes thousands of rural communities. It could have included tens of thousands of active family farms or collectives of family farms that were growing food, doing their day job or their weekend job, buying this from that person, selling that from that person, creating a circular economy, and providing that kind of base social and economic vitality that a democracy needs. So I'm swinging for the fences here, Errol, but we would be much better off if 40,000 landowners controlled those 40 million acres of GMO cropland. The problem is the GMO part of that, the synthetic biology part of that, wanted monoculture, wanted single or owners, wanted vast use of fertilizers and pesticides because it all made more money, right? And the government was in lockstep with all of that. That's the United States commons that we have lost, that we sold down the river. The other part of that commons is the topsoil that has been depleted by 70 to 80% and will not get back in 1,000 years, and the polluted waters and riverways and the Gulf of Mexico, which is a commons that we have ruined because of this technology. It's a really bad use of this technology. When you get into places like Africa, it gets really simple. The GMO lobby right now wants Tanzania to approve GMO, the use of GMOs, make it illegal for smallholders to reuse any seed. It has to be bought from a paragovernmental agency. They are going to push those smallholders off their land, create bigger farms, and put foreign or foreign controlled entities in charge of that land, spend tough to find currency by exporting raw materials, and they're going to bring in the fertilizers and the pesticides and the equipment. And the smallholder who can survive now is going to just be either unemployed, on welfare, or just a dime a day laborer on those big farms. That's
We know how history works with that. I mean, that's, you know, if you look at how that happened in England, you know, that led to the age of Dickens, and, you know, a lot of social upheaval and social revolution, you know, folks who are not busy working and, you know, displaced from, you know, their indigenous, you know, territories. I mean, that always leads to trouble. And it's just amazing to know that this is ongoing now. And so why Tanzania, though? Is there something about the land? Is there something about the climate? Is there something about the economy that these folks have sort of zeroed in on Southern Africa?
I think it has to do with a big amount of foreign investment. There's probably some debt. The World Bank and World Wildlife Fund, which act hand in hand, are probably have their fingers in this to redistribute all of that land and resources to bigger entities of which they are a part and which fund them, right? So the flip side is Malawi, formerly a kind of a bastardized cut up piece of land called Nyasaland. And I met with the Malawi delegation at the UN Convention for Biodiversity in Montreal a few years ago. And what I said to her was, I know you're deciding this, so let me just tell you. You're coming out of 100 years of colonization by white Europeans. The United States is being recolonized right now by this global agrochemical complex. Right? That's how you get 40 million acres in so few hands. That's why you get 210 million acres of GMO crops. That's why you get heavily subsidized ethanol. I said, please don't let yourself be recolonized. The United States can't remain a democracy the way it's being recolonized by the global trusts. And your only hope, even if you don't feel like you have the wealth that your neighbors may have, that's all temporary. In the long run, you'll have your sovereignty, you'll have your dignity, and you will control your destiny. Malawi has said no to GMOs. And man, if I could take credit for that, I would, but that would be quite a stretch. But you asked about why these other countries. Because there are leaders, because there are governments, because money's changing hands, because there are promised investments and debt relief. And in order to move forward on those big financial questions, the Global Agrochemical Trust is saying, give it up to GMOs. We're coming in. This is the extension of the Green Revolution, which did nothing for you, but this one will do more.
Yeah, and I'll say that another study just came out in the Geography Journal, once again showing that the Green Revolution literally did nothing, and it's all mythology. propagated by, you know, Western development on behalf of big agrochemical interests, you know, so it's more of that same. So, wow, we've kind of gone far and wide. Any more thoughts on some of those themes, Alan, just so folks kind of understand this broader context of synthetic biology and the next wave of GMOs?
Well, yeah, there are some great new publications. Let me just pull up the name of the one that I've been reading through that's easy to Google, easy to find. It's called Gene Editing, Myths and Reality, A Guide Through the Smokescreen. And it goes through all of the technical information that you are asking about just what this can and can't do and how it's being used. But I want to remind everyone of the trigger words and the propaganda. If you hear feed the world, you're afraid of science. Mm. Help me out. What are the other ones? Those are the two big ones. You're not a scientist. Someone screams at you, you're not a scientist.
I'll just say, actually, I am.
Well, and you can say you are, but another
the vast majority of people aren't. So I like the feed the world one, Alan. Actually, let's just rewind on that, because that is the trope that always, I think, triggers, oh no, that they're coming from that world. And, you know, I can explain it, you know, obviously with some of the things we've talked about on the show before. I'd like to hear from your perspective why the feed the world trope is so dangerous and folks need to understand what's behind that.
So I'll give you a real world example. I lived in Haiti for a couple of years, traveled the whole country on a motorbike, and did medical care, ran an orphanage, a whole bunch of agricultural outreach stuff. And at the time, one of the few things that Haiti didn't import was rice. They had a nice rice valley, plenty of water, really high quality rice. It was the rice that culturally the Haitians preferred. At the same time, USAID, International Development, was throwing out a whole bunch of mixed wheat products just to get them off the US market, get them into Haiti. And that stuff was given away. And anything that was in those bags, nobody could grow anymore because that was free. Well, the key moment here was when President Clinton, after the earthquake in Haiti, realized that all of his cronies in Arkansas, where we grow a lot of rice, had a huge surplus. Mm. Well, he loaded up multiple massive freighters with Arkansas rice paid for by taxpayers, US government money.
Always.
Sent it down to Haiti to save the Haitians. It decimated Haiti's agricultural sector when it comes to rice. Haiti no longer grows rice. It imports all of its rice.
Oh my God.
Because that export simply put them out of business. So I ask American producers to bring it home. Okay, so you're growing all these soybeans and corn and wheat to export, and you're going to give it away for free to Taiwan, to Korea, to China, to Zimbabwe, to Angola. So what would happen if they sent 100 million tons of wheat to the United States and gave it away? Well, they can't do that. What do you think's happened on that end, where you're solving your problem by decimating someone else's agricultural economy? So this was all, again, a big thing after World War II. It was all about centralizing, standardizing, consolidating as few farmers as possible with as much automated production as possible, and export the surplus, export, export, export. And the myth of famine went hand in hand with that dialogue. And now that we are really clear that famine is a political issue, not a physical or ecological one, we can see all the damage that was done. So why we have depleted our topsoil, poisoned 250 million acres with synthetic fertilizer and pesticides, destroyed the Gulf of Mexico in order to export more is just one of the great tragedies of history. There's the only way that this can be written is the great tragedy of the United States seeking short-term profit at the expense of its own land, its own communities, based on the proverbial idea of white saviorism that the poor folks in Africa need us to ship them food. You could quote me here.
Well, you're quoting yourself. You're recording on audio. We'll be posting this because that's great to hear.
That was a lot. I'm sorry, but
all good. No, because one of my favorite books from it was a couple decades ago was Mike Davis' Late Victorian Holocaust, which showed how the El Nino produced famines of the late 19th century were political situations. There were political decisions by essentially the British crown, you know, essentially the family that's still in charge now, you know, rotten hell, Prince Philip, and all the royals for all I care.
The entire Irish famine was a fiction.
The Irish famine was a political situation. There was plenty of food. It was just being exported out of the country. It was the same thing with India. So this is super helpful. So just the key thing here is when folks see the feed the world myth, when folks start propagating that, what's the elevator speech? Three sentences or less. Like, what can we all remember?
If someone justifies their technology because it's going to feed the world, you need to ask the world whether it wouldn't rather feed itself rather than be dependent on us. In every country can feed itself. The issues are about land reform, some climate change issues, some political issues. They can all feed themselves, and encouraging them to make the changes they need to feed themselves is a long-term solution that costs us nothing. And then we can look inward at our own house and start putting it in order.
It gets us right back to the conversation of food sovereignty that we've been having literally since episode one. So right on, Alan, thanks for tying that up in a neat little bow. So, you know, any closing thoughts on the subject, including any particular reading materials or other resources on these topics? You know, obviously I'll put out there the ETC group, the Et Cetera group is fantastic. Yeah. Bunch of nerds. Half the time I don't understand what they're saying, but man, that stuff is useful. What else you got that folks have, you know, for further reference?
I would say that getting a reread on Polanyi is really important.
You said Carl Polanyi?
Yeah.
Nice.
I don't want to misquote the title of the book. Maybe you could pull it up to put on the screen or something. But the true factual history of the early technologies and how they were used to create a police state to decimate communities and to impoverish.
The Great Transformation, Carl Polanyi.
Yes. And when you see that nothing has changed since that market capital system started to develop, when you see that the greatest police force ever deployed was to protect the mills from the Luddites who said, hey, this is not working for us. This is not supporting what we value. You can just transfer that lock, stock, and barrel to what's happening today in what seems complicated and confusing and conflicting, but in fact, it's the same process playing out. That's where I would start.
Same shit, different century. Right on, Alan. Alan Lewis, industry legend.
Errol, greater legend.
Whatever.
It's really been fun. Thank you.
Humble podcaster. It was great having you on, my friend.
Humble podcaster. Yeah, thanks. It was really great. Appreciate it.
Thanks, bud.